Mr. Duncan.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. In a Social Security disability hearing, the last two issues in the sequential process are whether the claimant can perform his past work, and if not, whether there's available work in the national economy in substantial numbers. The burden of proof shifts to the commissioner at this fifth step. Many times the commissioner, in order to satisfy their burden of proof, brings vocational experts to the hearing. Having been a practicing attorney in the administrative phase, basically vocational experts provide three primary functions. They provide a specific occupation that fits within the characteristics. They indicate what the exertional and non-exertional components are of that occupation, and they provide the number of available jobs in the national economy for that occupation. What the commissioner has failed to acknowledge in his arguments is that these three pieces of information are handled differently. This court, pursuant to its decisions...
That's called rack room? Rack room something? What is that?
A rack room worker...
Rack room.
If, for instance, like a plating or a part would be plated or would be coated or whatever, a rack room attendant would remove the items and place them on a rack to dry. That's my understanding of what that constitutes.
But your client can't see clearly.
Correct.
As I understand. He's at 2100 or something like that.
Correct. That's the whole point of this, is that the vocational expert in this particular case said that he could do that based on the residual functional capacity given to him in the hypothetical question.
What you describe as a rack room worker and would also apply to a packager, aren't these very heterogeneous jobs?
They do have a broad...
Packages are in all different sizes, and rack, I mean, that rack thing is so strange.
Well, that's exactly the point, Your Honor.
Be hanging carcasses of sheep on racks, I suppose. Or it could be blouses on racks. It seems very...
Correct. For example, a hand packager, one of the common employers is Figgies in northern Wisconsin. They package cheese, candies, and such many times for Christmas gifts.
Okay, so that would be sort of the fine stuff. But there's some gross packaging, isn't it?
That is correct. There is gross packaging. There's also people that would move larger boxes or things. The problem comes in is the larger of the items you get, the tendency is that they weigh more.
Right,
so if you have an RFC of light, you're basically going to be looking at smaller packages versus an RFC of medium or heavy, which is large packages. There's a separate category in the DOT for people who, like, unload trucks. Technically, they're doing the same type of work as somebody who works for Figgies, moving or packaging cheese and candy, but they're using bigger things, so there's a higher exertional category.
Well, what did the vocational expert say? So... were you the lawyer at the hearing?
No, Your Honor, I was not.
Okay, but his lawyer said, so then there would be no jobs in the national economy if you assume he couldn't do it because it was close work. And then he said, the vocational expert said, I eliminated those possibilities already. So does that mean, should we take that to mean that in reaching his conclusion of the 2,000 and the 800 jobs, he had eliminated all the fine packaging and hanging tiny things on racks and just the gross objects which he could see with his very poor vision were left. Is that what it means?
It may very well mean that, which is why the court has created all of these cases such as Donahue and McKinney. In my cases, I would have went further and demanded that he show me his calculations as to how he would come up with those numbers.
Right.
But you don't even need to reach that particular point because no matter how he factored or didn't factor, the definition in the Dictionary of Occupational Titles or the companion, the Selective Characteristics of Occupations, which is the thing created by the Department of Labor to make it more broad, clearly indicates that there's a requirement for most of these jobs beyond what's in the residual functional capacity. If the ALJ would have looked it up in the books that he has available. Almost everybody has a dictionary of occupational title who is in this area of law.
Okay, but suppose so he came up, didn't he? So this is in Minnesota, right? 800 rack room jobs and 2,000 hand packaging, something like that?
Correct. Okay.
Do we know what the universe is, right? So suppose there are 8,000 rack room jobs in Minnesota. Well, then his 800, you know, be very loose, but, you know, like 10%, couldn't we guess, or the board get, or the, you know, ALJ guess that, yeah, well, if there are 8,000 rack room jobs, yeah, probably he could do 10% of them. Is there anything in the record about the total number of these jobs?
No, Your Honor. And it's important to remember that the commissioner has the burden of proof at this step. So it's hard based on, well, I think and I kind of and maybe it's 10% to argue that that constitutes substantial evidence.
Well, the other problem here is that the 800 jobs were identified in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, as I understand the record, and Hayward is 3 hours away.
Correct.
And he presumably can't drive with his vision problems, right?
I hope not.
No mass transit in that
terrifying
part of the state of Wisconsin.
The glaucoma, too.
So I don't know how realistic that is.
Well, and the numbers and on how they calculate these, I've seen them where there's a requirement of giving national numbers. I've seen them where they give state numbers. There's been a very loose configuration as to where they get their numbers. I've seen it just rationalized as being the regional area. I guess they're expecting that some people will just be able to readily move to a different area for employment.
Well, that expectation is entirely unrealistic in this case, given his how compromised his vision is.
Correct.
And there was no effort to identify how many of these sorts of jobs were available in this part of northern Wisconsin.
Even though it is contrary to my own position, the Social Security regulations are blind on that issue as long as there's a sufficient number. In the state of Wisconsin or in the state of Minnesota, they may all be in Madison and my client may live in Hayward, but Social Security doesn't care.
Don't they usually look at the person's state rather than a different state?
They tend to.
Because it's not that easy, sometimes not that easy to move across state lines. He might have some benefits in Wisconsin because of his problems.
They do tend to look at the states, Your Honor. In fact, there was a case, the Barrett versus Barnhart decision, that I believe you wrote, Judge Posner. You put in there the reference to state numbers, and the commissioner filed an objection, and you wrote a supplemental opinion indicating that state numbers or national numbers is relevant because they tend to use state numbers anyway. So this is not uncommon that the numbers vary from place to place.
Mm-hmm. Okay, want to save the rest of your time?
Yes, Your Honor, I would. Thank you.
Mr. Thomas?
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Bill Thomas for the Commissioner of Social Security. Mr. Overman's sole claim for remand in this matter is that the ALJ didn't comply with Social Security Ruling 004P. SSR 004P requires an ALJ to ask a VE whether his or her testimony...
Where did he get these numbers from, the 2,000 and the 800? Didn't he
I believe
pull them
it's
out of
12,
his hat? Didn't he take them?
It's 1,200 and 800, Your Honor.
1,200 and 800? Sorry.
1,000 total. That was a question that should have been asked of the VE at the hearing if Mr. Overman wanted to. An ALJ is entitled to rely on uncontradicted expert testimony.
No, but how could he just pull out of his hat these numbers, right? So you have two very heterogeneous job categories. Undoubtedly, there are some jobs in each of some jobs in each category that a person, even with a terrible vision that Mr. Overman has, could do. But how could he, on the spur of the moment, or maybe it wasn't the spur of the moment, but wouldn't any judge want to ask him how he had arrived at those numbers?
Well, I think one of the reasons the agencies rely on vocational experts, Your Honor, is that they have considerable experience in the matter. I believe the vocational expert in this case, his resume is on page 64 of the administrative record. He's been doing this for 16 years, placing individuals with disabilities in jobs and has a master's degree in vocational rehabilitation. So ALJs originally assume in the over 500 million cases that are adjudicated a year that the vocational experts know what they're talking about. And especially in this kind of case where the claimant is represented by counsel, if they really do have a problem with the jobs provided by the VE, they have the opportunity to cross-examine, which they took in this case. And they didn't bother asking about the jobs. The VE actually provided the Dictionary of Occupational Title codes. They had the opportunity to ask about the codes. They had the opportunity to ask where the VE got those numbers from. Even after the hearing, they had the opportunity to provide additional requests to the VE or to the ALJ about those numbers, and they never did. Where the expert's testimony is uncontradicted, it's reasonable for a judge to rely on that expert.
But don't the regulations require that both the rack room workers and the hand packagers they are supposed to have pretty good vision, aren't they?
Well, Judge, it's not in the regulations precisely. Well, it's in the
area or whatever.
It's actually in a supplement or a complement to the dictionary called the SCO. And the regulations themselves only require that the ALJ, if they rely on VE testimony to elicit a significant number of jobs at Step 5, to make sure that those jobs are consistent with the dictionary. The ALJ asked the question in this case. The VE said, yes, they're consistent. It turns out that, plaintiff's counsel identified in the judicial proceedings potential conflicts,
right,
but they weren't brought up at a point where the ALJ could have done anything about them. And I think the heart of this case is that Mr. Overman is asking you to remand this case and make an ALJ know more about vocational information than the vocational experts do. That's just not reasonable. They're entitled to rely on experts. That's why the agency uses them in these sorts of proceedings. And they're free to attack the credibility of the VE or at least their expertise, where they got their numbers from.
This isn't really an issue of credibility, though. It's an issue of whether what he said in response to that question is, in fact, true, which it's not.
But that's true, Your Honor, but I think ultimately the issue is whether the Step 5 finding was undermined by that. And the truth is,
The dictionary says that these jobs require a certain level of visual acuity that this...
Well, but the dictionary is not canonical. I think that's one of the errors that are being propounded here by Mr. Overman. The commissioner's regulations recognize...
Wouldn't the VE have had to have done some individual analysis of this fellow's conditions relative to those jobs for that to really carry any...
Yes, and I absolutely, Your Honor. And I think the issue, what's happening here is the VE doesn't have to agree with the DOT. Just because the DOT says something doesn't make it true across the board in the United States everywhere. This particular vocational expert presumably has more local expertise about those particular jobs than a book that was written, I'm not sure how many years ago.
But he didn't distinguish the jobs that he was identifying as available to the petitioner from the description of those jobs in the DOT. He just said the two were consistent, as I understand the record. Isn't that right?
He didn't need to distinguish them. Admittedly, the VE made an error, but what I'm addressing here is the fact that that's not a cause for remand. The ALJ can still rely on the VE's testimony because it would be reasonable for the ALJ to find that the VE's testimony is more credible than a static book. If I may continue.
An awful lot of weight on his statement, I eliminated those possibilities already. That's your whole case is on that. Whatever exactly he meant.
Well, I think the transcript is, if it was read, it does clearly indicate the attorney wasn't cross-examining on the DOT or any potential conflict with the DOT. The attorney was cross-examining on an entirely different hypothetical from the one the ALJ provided. The attorney provided a different set of parameters, and the VE said, well, yeah, if you applied those parameters, the jobs would be eliminated. So it, you know, it's,
but he clearly has significant reading problems, right?
Well, Your Honor,
a terrible vision.
Yes, but I think first of all, I believe he says in the transcript that he can actually drive in the daytime. I'm not an expert. I don't know
thought.
What. I'm pretty
drive,
sure we could all agree he can't drive at night. But I have no competency to talk about how blind he is. But there was a medical expert at that hearing, and the medical expert looked at the vision testing, and the medical expert didn't say, "Oh, this guy can't see anything. He probably shouldn't be allowed to work." You know, the doctor didn't say that. So it would kind of be impetuous of us to, at this point, to say, "Oh, well, based on what, you know, 2100, that sounds bad. He probably can't do any of these things." That's not what the record shows.
Well, that falls below the standard required for a driver's license, doesn't it?
I'm not sure, actually. But, you know, he did indicate he could drive, and that he
did drive. There's another curiosity here. So when the ALJ gave the vocational expert his instructions, he didn't say there were reading limitations, did he?
He did, actually.
The ALJ did?
Yeah, the RFC to the vocational expert indicated gross but not fine discrimination and also no significant amounts of reading. And that ties into the second part of the cross-examination when, on page 481 of the administrative record, when the attorney says, so if he had to read, the VE responds, if he had to read to do it, I would say those jobs would be eliminated, yes. So that was something the VE took into consideration before he provided the jobs.
So you think he went through the jobs in Minnesota and he cut out all the ones that would require fine work? That's your argument?
That's what the VE said he did. Now, as to what the basis of his numbers were, that's something that should have been brought up at the hearing. You know, to speculate about it now doesn't really undermine the Step 5 finding. The truth is the VE provided jobs and said that he took that into account, and no one contradicted him when they had plenty of opportunity to do so.
Do you have anything further?
Yes, Judge, if I may. I think that Mr. Oberman's case hinges on this idea that there was an apparent conflict between the vocational expert's testimony and the DOT that the ALJ should have been signaled to understand and be aware of, even though Mr. Oberman was represented and had someone there, an attorney there, who also didn't notice it. And I think that the heart of this case is that you can't expect an ALJ to know more than a vocational expert about what the DOT requires or what the SCO, which is another book altogether separate from the DOT, requires. To do that would require an ALJ to go and do considerable research outside of the expert testimony provided, and that wouldn't be practical in these cases.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr.
Yeah.
Thomas. So, Mr. Duncan, how much time does he have?
Judge, two points. One is that whether we look at the numbers or don't look at the numbers, the issue also rests on the application of the ruling itself. In the Prochaska decision, this court indicated that if the judge does not ask the question, even if the attorney for the applicant does nothing at the hearing except sit on his hands, that's still grounds to remand because the commissioner's regulation mandate that the ALJ take the action. Well, there's two parts to that ruling. One, the ALJ is to ask, and two, he's to identify apparent conflicts. Well, it would make absolutely no sense for this court to rule that the first prong cannot be waived by the inaction of the claimant's attorney, and the second prong can be waived, that it would be inconsistent. It should be that if the ruling applies on the first prong, it should apply on the second prong, no matter whether the claimant's attorney asks or doesn't, it's not waived. As far as this issue of apparent conflicts, I guess the point I would just want to point to is the Hackett decision from the Tenth Circuit. That case overturned it because the ALJ's residual functional capacity limited him to simple routine work, which by the nature of Social Security usually means unskilled, which is an SVP 1 or 2 in the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. But in that case, the court found that since the job cited was an SVP 3, that should have been picked up. To say simply that the ALJ doesn't know or shouldn't know or has to do research is not the case. When you're working with this stuff every day, day in and day out, and it's your only area that you're working on, you become familiar. I've had many cases, many hearings, where the ALJ will start asking about the application of jobs not even considered or cited by the vocational expert in the hearing. The judges have a very good command of this, and I don't think it causes them any undue burden for them simply to be required to look a little bit further as they're writing their decisions and apply the ruling, since the commissioner wrote the ruling, interpreted the ruling, they should have to comply with it as well.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Duncan and Mr. Thomas.